Hello and welcome to another edition of Inquisitive Minds on Brock Radio, CFPU FM. My name is Mike Saunders, and each week at this time, we explore some of the fascinating research being done by Brock University faculty and students, as well as address relevant issues that could impact the Brock community. On today's show, we talk to the president of the Brock Faculty Association with her take on the deficit reduction town hall meeting held earlier this month at Brock. We find out about the many attributes of tea from the winner of Brock's three-minute thesis competition. And with the education calendar winding down for another semester, I thought it might be timely to revisit an interview from December with the author of Town and Gown, From Conflict to Cooperation. Sharing a cup of Darjeeling on an April day, Inquisitive Minds is on the air. Last week on the program, we looked at the deficit reduction plans announced earlier this month at a town hall meeting held at Brock, where it was announced the university's operating deficit had to be trimmed from the present $14.5 million to $7 million. Next year will not be any easier, but as we heard last week on Inquisitive Minds, administration will bear the brunt of deficit reductions for the time being. Vice President of Finance and Administration at Brock, Brian Hutchings, explained that so far, 40 job eliminations have been achieved through voluntary resignations or retirements, while another 9 full-time staff members have been redeployed to vacancies, and 10 have in fact lost their jobs. It is anticipated another 27 jobs will be cut through attrition, redeployment, and, if necessary, layoffs. None of those positions are expected to be from faculty, although a review of academic programming is ongoing. Predictably, not everyone is happy about the job losses and how savings are being achieved. One of those expressing concern is our first guest today, Linda Rose Krasner, a professor in the Department of Psychology and president of the Brock Faculty Association. I asked Dr. Rose Krasner what she sees as the flaw in the plans to be put in place at Brock to reduce the deficit.
Well, I think we've been looking at the budget estimates for the next year and beyond, and our budget analysis committee that the union has put together, which comprises two accountants and a professor who specializes in organizational processes, has looked at the assumptions that underlie the budget. And we think that there are a number of very conservative assumptions that make the budget seem perhaps larger than it needs to be if those assumptions were challenged. So one of the things that we've done is to try to get people to look critically at the underlying assumptions that determine the budget. We also think that the main drivers of the budget deficit haven't been clearly articulated, and the processes that led to that budget deficit and those drivers need to be examined again in a critical framework.
Well, it looks like primarily it's going to be administrative staff that will be affected by the deficit reductions, at least in the first round, in the short term. So is that a problem?
Yes, absolutely, because many of those administrative staff support the academic core mission of the university. So the faculty in delivering the academic programs depend very heavily on the staff that we work with to make those programs work well.
So basically what you're saying is without that available support staff, it just makes the job that much more difficult.
Yes, and it threatens the effective delivery and the quality of the delivery of those academic programs to the students.
Some people have noted there's not a lot of senior administrative staff affected by this.
Yes, that seems to be the case. And indeed, the number of senior administrative staff since 2006-2007 has increased by 40%. The salary costs of administration and professional level positions since the same time has increased 28%, with a faculty increase of 0.01% for the same time. So we do think that there's been a large increase in administrative costs out of proportion to what's happening elsewhere in the university. And I might add, the chair of the Board of Trustees is leading a campaign for the salaries of senior administrative staff to be unfrozen and to for the province not to be able to limit the compensation for senior staff at the time that all these job cuts are happening. So that's a little concerning as well.
So in other words, administrative cuts, but they're in the wrong areas.
We, as a union, regret any job loss, but we think that if they have to occur, that the administration, senior administration, to look to its own costs first before it cuts the most vulnerable members of the Brock community.
Now, you're president of the Brock Faculty Association. No faculty positions have been affected. I've talked to many faculty members over the past year on my program, some of whom have expressed in private concerns about what might be looming. And I think some of them were fully expecting there would be job losses at the faculty level. That was not the case. So how do you approach that? A good thing, or maybe that should have been looked at as well?
No. Faculty are the front line on the delivery of the academic programs. Faculty numbers have not increased, as I said, since 2006, 2007, while the numbers of students have increased dramatically over those years. So our argument is that the faculty complement is already too low. So the loss of faculty jobs, again, would substantially and negatively impact on the academic programming.
So there's assurances right now no faculty positions would be lost. That might not be the case in the future.
Yes, certainly a lot would have to happen before faculty positions were lost.
Now, you're quoted to have said some of the building decisions made at Brock over the years have not been particularly wise ones. So what buildings are you referring to?
Well, the one that pops out, I think, most strikingly is the Cairns Building, which was built without any additional teaching space. Increasing teaching space is one way that the university in the past has funded some of the building costs. So the lack of this additional revenue is problematic in terms of covering the cost of the building. The building was expected to generate revenue in terms of rental of space and facilities. That has not materialized. The building was built in a way that the operating costs are huge. And the building was built in a way that there are construction issues that are requiring some fixing. And we understand even some litigation about problems that are now being revealed in the construction.
So these are after the fact then. Once it's gone up, there are still problems that have to be dealt with.
Yes, things that are falling off. And so I think the argument is that, yes, additional research space was needed, that is being provided by the Cairns Building, but the size of the building, the cost of the building, the way it was perhaps financed, and the way it seems to have been contracted out are all things that need to be looked at.
Now, that's the Cairns Complex, which is really, as I mentioned to Brian last week on the program, it's a bit of a lightning rod because it is so visible. You cannot escape it. But is that the only building where there are problems, or is that just the most obvious one?
I think it's the most obvious one because it's the most expensive one. And also, as you said, it's drawing a lot of attention given its salience on the campus and that we can see all the cranes that are coming in to try to fix the problems with it. 198 St. Paul, I think the jury's still out on that one. We don't know what the final cost will be for the building of it, except that it is over budget. And there's yet another building on the horizon, a building for the business faculty that looks like it's going to go forward. And so there are a lot of questions about, is this the right time for that? Or is the decision-making which led to the problems in the past still problematic? And whether we should be going ahead and incurring more building costs at this point.
When I addressed the issue, especially with the Cairns Complex with Brian Hutchings last week, he basically used the if we build it, they will come approach. In other words, we need the facilities to attract the staff and the students who will populate the building. And I can see where he's coming from on that. Is that the case? Or is the building more than Brock needs at this point in time?
Given the occupancy rate and the number of researchers that are currently operating in it, to our knowledge, it hasn't happened as they had hoped it would happen.
But it hasn't been open that long, though. I mean, I think what they're saying is give it time and you'll see.
Well, I guess our position at this point would be, is this the time to do that kind of speculation? I mean, if people are losing their jobs, the academic mission is being threatened by the operating budget cuts that are coming forward and will continue to come forward, it looks like. So is this the time to engage in perhaps a somewhat speculative revenue-generating scheme without guarantees?
Right. Now, I can see not building another expensive building because of the current financial situation. But as far as the Cairns Complex is concerned, for example, it's there. We've built it. We've spent the money on it. We can't make it disappear. So we have to make the best of the situation. So how do you do that?
I think through a couple of ways. One is to seriously consult with the Brock community, which have not yet been done, to look at ways of additional revenue generation and additional cost saving. Been, to this point, a very top-down approach. We are a community of very creative and intelligent and committed people. And so I think there needs to be a greater involvement of the Brock community to looking at both ways of cost saving and revenue generating. I think a critical look at the budget might suggest that some assumptions are changed, the size of the deficit changes, whether we need to spend $6 million in deferred maintenance this year, or whether some of it could be postponed, whether the discount rate in the pension plan is estimates are valid ones, change that, change the amount of money that has to go in the pension this time around. I mean, there's a number of budget assumptions that could be looked at. The board's mandate that the budget has to go to zero in 1 year seems to be a little draconian. Other universities have spread out that kind of goal over several years. So I think looking at creative solutions like job sharing and retirement incentives may help reduce the deficit in less painful ways. So I think there's a number of things that could be done that aren't being done.
So in other words, the battle should not be on the backs of the workers themselves entirely. There are other ways where you can find cost savings and save money in those areas that wouldn't have the same impact.
We think so.
Yeah. Okay. Do you think this is the end of it, or would we expect more in the future?
No, we heard at Planning Priorities and Budget Advisory Committee this week that it looks like the university may have a budget estimate for next year that doesn't quite get it to zero, and that therefore over the course of the next year there will be additional mitigating actions to get that budget down. So we do not believe that the job cuts will end this spring, this summer.
And that was President of the Brock Faculty Association and a professor in the Department of Psychology, Linda Rose Krasner, with her take on the deficit town hall held earlier this month. Next week, we'll continue our conversation with Dr. Rose Krasner about her research into youth engagement at Brock. Incidentally, we have contacted Dan Crow, president of the Canadian Union of Public Employees Local 4207, and also hope to have him on the show in the near future to respond as well. Earlier this month, the Mapping the New Knowledges Graduate Student Research Conference was held at Brock University. And part of that event on the Monday was the finals in the 3-minute thesis competition. Or were the finals? Anyway, you might recall I was one of the judges at the preliminary round in late February up at Brock, and we narrowed the field down from 12 contestants to 5 at that point. Essentially, graduate students had just 3 minutes to explain their thesis in plain, simple terms with just one visual aid. The competition was stiff, and it was not easy picking the 5 finalists back then, so I can imagine what the judges had to contend with 2 weeks ago, narrowing the field down to just 2. But they did, and the winner will go on to the provincial thesis competition April 24th at McMaster University. The 2 winners were Andra Lenius in second spot, winning $250, and Leslie Nash. She earned the top spot and a $500 prize and the chance to compete at McMaster this week. Leslie's presentation, very near and dear to my heart, I might add, was entitled Simplicity, Investigating Tea as a Dietary Strategy for Better Bone Health. And she joined us in our CFPU studios following the competition to talk about her thesis, the win at Brock, and of course, to deliver her 3-minute thesis in the studio. I asked her if she was at all surprised by her success.
Yes, actually. I really don't like public speaking, and I was absolutely terrified. So I'm very surprised that I actually pulled through with this.
Now, I was one of the judges at the February preliminary.
Yep.
I was amazed by the breadth of subject matter that was covered. When you're sitting there watching the people do theirs before you go up, mm-hmm. are you assessing them?
The first time around when we did the preliminary round, I was, which was terrifying because then you realize how good the competition is, which just makes you more terrified. But when it came to the finals, I tried not to pay attention because my nerves were just so high that I just kept looking at the ground, trying not to pay attention.
So you're trying to focus doing a good job
exactly.
yourself.
Yeah.
yeah. So the competition, as I say, in the preliminaries was strong. It must have been even stronger in the final.
Oh, definitely. Very good presentations.
Yeah. Now, I had to miss the final. I was in Toronto for a conference, so I wasn't able to take part in it. But how nerve-wracking was it for you?
Well, let's put it this way. When I went up to go get mic'd, I couldn't even handle the mic. I dropped it. Then I tried to hook it onto myself and proceeded to drop it again. And I was shaking so much that I couldn't even hook it onto my belt, and I actually had to have the tech come in and do it for me.
But I remember when, at the preliminaries, you were very calm, cool, and collected.
That's what it looks like.
Yeah, so what you're telling me, and this is very true for me too in my mm-hmm. profession, you present the image of being calm, cool, and collected.
Yeah.
But inside, your stomach is churning because you're a bundle of nerves.
Oh, yeah.
Is that...
Trying not to freak out, but I really wanted to.
Yeah. Were you surprised at all? First of all, that you got to the final, and then that you won.
I was pretty surprised that I won. I had a lot of comments and feedback with people supporting me, but of course, they're my supervisors or my colleagues, so I kind of expected their support. But yeah, like I thought that the competition was very tight, and because there were such a vast range of topics and a vast range of judges, so we didn't have academic judges, they came from different areas, it was really hard to pick out where their thoughts were going to be on a particular topic, whether like one better than the other. So I really didn't expect it. It was actually very surprising when I was sitting there, but obviously I'm more than pleased to win.
The winner last year, I remember reading about the winner last year. I remember her saying she found it so difficult to compress a thesis into 3 minutes mm-hmm. because essentially every single word matters. You cannot leave a word in there that doesn't matter.
Yeah.
So how difficult was that for you? And what process did you go through to condense it and rehearse it and be ready?
Actually, the reason why I took on doing the 3MT is because I have the biggest problem in the world with being concise. I love going to conferences just to hear everyone else talk, but when I have to talk, it seems like I can just ramble on. So I took on the project to begin with was because I need to be able to be short and succinct and get to the point. So it was an interesting project with trying to write out a beginning, middle, and end to what I wanted to say, but say it in enough time where I wasn't going to be eliminated for going past 3 minutes. So I wrote down points in essentially point form, things I need to get across to the audience, because I had to remember it's a general audience. They don't have the background I have. So I would write out things that were going to be important to them. So such as the rates of osteoporosis, how likely is it going to affect them, what different bone cells were, because I wanted to make sure that when I ended up talking about what I do, they understand what the bone cells are and why they are important to be studied. And everyone loves tea, so it makes it really relevant to them. So I would write it out in point form, try different types of speeches, and then I would actually tell my parents what I was talking about, and just to get feedback from other individuals as well who weren't in my background to see if they could understand certain words, and then I kind of put the speech together from there.
Yeah, because that's the key. It has to be understood by us people yep. who don't theoretically know anything you're talking about. And that's what I try to do on the program here is make a complex subject matter accessible.
Mm-hmm.
That's what you do, but you have to do it in 3 minutes.
Yeah, absolutely terrifying.
So how many rewrites did you go through?
Oh, I probably went through about 2 weeks straight of just completely changing it one thing after another, because I would find out maybe one word doesn't make sense to people, so you'd have to explain it in 3 or 4 words as opposed to one. Then you go back and you realize you're 3 minutes and 20 seconds, but you don't want to also just be at 3 minutes because you're still cutting it too close, because you know when you go up and speak, your voice and your pace changes. So I wanted to be about 2:50, so I had to cut it back even more. So it was several weeks, and even up to the final competition, I was adding and changing things. So it's consistently essentially evolving, I guess.
Hmm. Yeah, I found at the preliminaries, at least when I was judging, several of them were short.
Mm-hmm.
And it's probably better that you were short a few seconds than over.
Oh, yes.
Because then you're cut off
yep.
and you're not able to get to that final statement
yep.
that really wraps everything all together mm-hmm. for you.
Yeah, we were actually told if we spoke a moment past 3 minutes, we would be eliminated. So I think it was that fear that kind of struck in me that I didn't want to be anywhere near the 3 minutes.
Well, you seem to do fine. I think all of the topics were just amazing. Mm-hmm. It was great subject matter, but yours was near and dear to my heart. And we talked about this before we started doing the interview today. Tea is my passion. I've been a tea drinker for years. I knew a lot of the health benefits of tea, and I think a lot of people do. But you took it one step further, and you're basically saying, as we'll discover when you do your three-minute thesis in a moment here, the benefits of tea go far beyond what we've already known, I would think.
Mm-hmm. Actually, my supervisor also has a love for tea, and so when I joined her research, she really wanted to pursue the benefits of tea because we are finding that habitual consumption of tea is leading to individuals who have a lower rate of osteoporosis. But no one has gone that step to figure out why or what are the mechanisms within the body that are contributing to lower risk of osteoporosis. So we decided to investigate that.
Okay, well, before we get to discussing your research, mm-hmm. we need to hear your three-minute thesis. So if you're ready,
okay.
don't worry, there's no stopwatch. So we're not going to be timing you on this one, although it's probably better that you try to keep it at 3 minutes.
Yeah.
But if you're good, then we'll go through this, and then we'll explore what you discuss in your three-minute thesis. So if you're ready.
Okay. Approximately 1 in 5 men and 1 in 3 women will be diagnosed with osteoporosis within their lifetime. In 2013, osteoporotic fractures made more hospital visits than heart attack, stroke, and breast cancer combined. Moreover, 1 in 3 men and women will die within their first year of obtaining a fracture to the hip. But osteoporosis isn't just a health burden, it's an economic one, in which over $20 billion are spent on individuals with osteoporosis every single year in North America. So what is osteoporosis? Osteoporosis is a disease characterized by thin, porous bones as a result of low bone mineral density, which increases your risk to fracture. Bone, originally thought to be very static, we now know is consistently changing, always being built up and broken back down. And this is by two cell types, osteoblasts, cells that make bone, and osteoclasts, cells that break down bone. It is primarily the ratio that exists between these two cell types that decide whether there is a net gain or a net loss of bone. At about our early 30s, we see that there is a steady decrease in bone mineral density throughout our lives. But for women, this is much more dramatic as we go through menopause due to the loss of estrogen. Estrogen, we now know, is very important for bone health as it contributes to increasing osteoblastic activity as well as increasing the total amount of mineral within our bodies. But recent research across the world is now suggesting that habitual consumption of tea leads to an increase in bone mineral density and a lower risk of fracture. So I decided to investigate why this is by looking at the main component of tea, which are flavonoids. Flavonoids are chemical compounds naturally produced by plants that give rise to tea's taste, color, and smell. So what I did for my research is I took different types of flavonoids found within the tea, and I added them to human osteoblastic cells to see what would happen. And what we found is that with an increasing concentration of these flavonoids, we had an increase in cell division, an increase in osteoblastic activity, and an increase in total mineral. We believe this is occurring because flavonoids have a similar structure to estrogen and therefore may act as an estrogen mimic. This means when you consume tea, the flavonoids will bind to estrogen receptors found within the bone and promote those same favorable outcomes that estrogen naturally does. So in conclusion, habitual consumption of tea leads to an increased intake of flavonoids, which help to promote osteoblastic activity to produce more mineral. More mineral means you're going to have stronger bones and you're less likely to fracture. So next time you're at home, think about your bone health and be like Mr. T and brew something good.
That was great.
Thank you.
That was super. And I was timing you. You were pretty close.
What time? What was it?
You were just under 3 minutes.
Good. That's
excellent.
Always good to hear.
That's always good to hear. Before we talk about the research, did you get any advice from the judges last week after the presentation?
Not yet. I'm going to be sitting down with John, and we're going to go over any advice that the judges did give, and we're going to go over my slide as well, just to make sure everything's pristine for the final competition.
Yeah, I was curious about how much preparation you have to go through now, because it's almost like now you're going to the prize fight.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you're going down to MAC on April 24th. So the competition isn't over for you. It's no. almost just beginning.
Yeah, especially because you don't really know what to expect. You're now competing with the top of each of the universities, and they're all coming together. So it's going to be more terrifying in a sense where you want to kind of see what the competition's like. But at the same time, I think I'm going to have my nerves through the roof. So I want to focus on my own presentation so that when I can go up there, I can deliver my speech and do it in a timely manner.
It's going to be so nerve-wracking, you're going to need a tea before you get
oh,
up there.
Oh, definitely, definitely.
Absolutely. Is tea a relaxant for you?
I actually, in the beginning, I relied actually more on coffee than drinking tea. But when I started doing more research on tea, I started to consume it a lot more. I actually really like herbal teas more than just black tea or green tea. But yeah, it tastes really good.
Okay, well, let's talk about your findings. The flavonoids, that's really the basis of what makes tea so useful,
yep.
I think.
Yep.
The flavonoids and the estrogen for women, are the flavonoids essentially going to replace the estrogen?
No. Estrogen has an estrogen receptor, and estrogen, therefore, is the natural ligand for that receptor. So when you're consuming flavonoids, it's more likely that the estrogen will beat out the flavonoids to binding. But we're hoping that in postmenopausal women who don't have the estrogen, that the flavonoids will replace that binding, that need to create the bone markers that is done through binding of estrogen.
So as far as male and female is concerned, is tea better for one or the other, or are there suitable beneficial qualities for both?
Well, as far as bone is concerned, we are seeing more benefits for women. There's probably about 23 different studies that have been done across populations around the world, and we're seeing that the majority of the benefits are in women, where men, it seems to be left out. But men produce estrogen, but in a different way. So testosterone is actually converted into estrogen, and that's where men get their bone health from. And men don't see that type of decline in testosterone that women see with their estrogen levels. So that may be why we're not seeing the benefits.
Hmm. Is it only the flavonoids that have the beneficial effect, or are there other beneficial effects to tea that affect our bone health?
We strongly believe it's the flavonoids, fluoride, and caffeine. So depending on what type of tea you're consuming, caffeine is a diuretic. So it actually prevents calcium absorption, and calcium is very important for your bone. So we know caffeine is not beneficial for bone health. And fluoride is very controversial. It's helpful for your teeth and maintaining the strength of your teeth, but as far as bone is concerned, we're finding at higher consumptions of fluoride, something called fluorosis happens, and it's when your bones become very brittle. So we know fluoride is not contributing to your bone health. And the other main component now is the flavonoids, and because of their estrogen mimics, we believe that that's where we're getting the benefits from.
Now, what type of tea were you studying? Are we concentrating more on black tea here, or did you look at the benefits of green tea?
I'm actually looking at rooibos tea. So it's it's a South African tea. It's a red bush tea. The reason why I decided to look at rooibos specifically is because it's actually a new upcoming tea. Before, you couldn't find it anywhere in Ontario, and now it seems to be off the shelves, even in cans.
Yeah.
But the main benefit of rooibos tea is you get the flavonoid content of a black tea, but without the caffeine. So we're removing the detriment of the caffeine while also maintaining the flavonoid content, which is what we believe is helping bone.
So how did you go about conducting the research then?
So lots of reading, essentially, literature research on the different types of flavonoids found within teas. When we decided to narrow it down to rooibos tea, I did a lot of extensive research deciding on what type of flavonoids enter plasma, so may give you the beneficial effects, or which flavonoids you just excrete out so that don't really see the inside of your body. I wanted to make sure that the flavonoids I looked at have high concentrations within the tea, so they're really relevant to us. And then I kind of went from there with choosing about 6 or 7 different flavonoids and subjecting them to human osteoblast cells.
So are the properties different depending on the type of tea then?
We believe so, mainly depending on the type of flavonoids that are found within the tea and how much flavonoids. So depending on the type of flavonoids, you can have different behavior. So stronger antioxidant behavior, we can produce maybe more mineral or increasing bone activity depending on the type of flavonoid. But if you also have more flavonoids in one tea versus another, then you'll see more beneficial effects as well.
In your 3-minute thesis, you refer to habitual drinking of tea. What constitutes habitual? And the reason I'm asking this is because we're always told with some things, too much of a good thing is not good. So can you go overboard, or is more tea better?
For the majority of the studies we looked at, habitual consumption was defined as an individual who consumes usually 2 cups or more a day. And more studies were specific as to even say a minimum of 2 years consumption, where anything less than that, they didn't see any benefits as of yet. Obviously, if you drink too much tea, there are always issues such as fluorosis. There's many journals who actually record individuals who consume iced tea, for example, liters upon liters in a day, and they'll end up losing dramatic amounts of weight as well as bone. And they'll end up coming in and they'll be diagnosed with fluorosis, and it's because of the fluoride content in tea.
But there's more sugar, I think, in iced tea, for example, and that's a concern too.
Oh yeah, definitely, definitely. Especially with the average weight of the population increasing, diabetes increasing, it's definitely worse to drink iced tea.
There's another thesis right there, you know. So how do you apply this research that you've done? How do we apply this to everyday life?
Well, I think it's first characterizing what's going on with the flavonoids. So we're now seeing that with the specific flavonoids that I've chosen from the tea, that we are seeing an increase in mineralization. We are able to pick out the pathways that we believe are promoting this behavior. So it then becomes down to looking at the content in which the flavonoids exist in the tea. Are they relevant to us? Are we going to get these effects by just consuming tea, or do we need to take it up a notch and maybe consume supplements? And at this time, we're believing that it's going to be more relevant at the supplement level as opposed to drinking tea, especially if you want more immediate effects as opposed to long-term. But again, we are seeing with these studies that do look at long-term consumers of tea that we are seeing benefits. So it may be just that thing where you have to work your way up with consuming tea on a daily basis for many years that you'll end up with a higher bone mineral density.
Beyond April 24th, when the provincial competition comes up at MAC, what's the future hold for you? What do you want to do beyond the 3-minute thesis competition and your graduate studies?
I actually want to continue to do research. I absolutely love being in the lab. My friends like to joke and call me a lab rat because I'll be there from 8 in the morning until 10 at night, maybe later if that's what it takes. I would like to go to Ottawa and work in drug and vaccine development and doing gene therapy. I have a background in biotechnology, so development of vaccines and drugs and helping cure a disease is something that you could only dream of, and I would love to pursue that.
You've got a bright future ahead of you.
I hope so.
Thanks to tea.
Yeah, definitely.
One of the things I noticed with the competition, did you notice that the vast majority of the people who were taking part in this were from Applied Health Sciences?
I did notice that at the end when we realized that the final five that was going on and 4 out of the 5 were Applied Health, it was really nice to see, just because we actually have a really great community within Applied Health. I find not all the faculties are as tight or maybe are involved with each other as we are. So it was really nice to see your friends continue on.
There's so many things going on in Applied Health Sciences. There's so many varied subjects that can be explored. In a way, it doesn't surprise me that a number of them came from there, but it's just astounding that so much work is being done in Applied Health Sciences, and you're a part of it. So, Leslie, thank you very much for coming in. Congratulations on your win at Brock.
Thank you.
Coming up on the 24th, you're going to be at MAC. We wish you all the best. And beyond that, with your future work. Thank you for coming in.
Thank you for having me.
And that was Leslie Nash, an Applied Health Sciences master's student at Brock, who won the local 3-minute thesis competition a couple of weeks ago now. And this week, Leslie competes in the provincial competition held at McMaster. We'll keep you posted on her progress at MAC. In the meantime, good luck to Leslie, and have a cup of tea to calm your nerves if you need it. the university town, that acclimation has its good points and its bad. University town, well, it sees a lot of benefits coming from the relationship, be they economic, cultural, and so on. But being a university town sometimes presents problems too. Off-campus behavior, for example, or the need for adequate and safe housing within the community. These issues and more have been addressed in a new book entitled Town and Gown, From Conflict to Cooperation. Its author is Michael Fox. It's published by Municipal World Books. Michael Fox is a professor in the Department of Geography and Environment at Mount Allison University in Sackville, New Brunswick, and a member of the International Town and Gown Association and the Town and Gown Association of Ontario. We caught up with Professor Fox at his home in New Brunswick for an interview back in December on the program, and I asked him about the Town and Gown Association.
Well, the Town and Gown Association, there's actually one close to home, certainly close to Brock, and that's the Town and Gown Association of Ontario. And they've developed over about the last 10 years, but they've really been going for the last 20, 25 years, essentially to address the issues and opportunities that having a university in your community can present. And by and large, I think it's fair to say most of the time it's been negative, so some sort of orientation week issue, student parties get out of hand, police called in, those sorts of things. It just was a series of universities and communities across Ontario that started to have these issues. They also had some student housing issues back in the day, and of course still today with rooming houses and too many people in too small a building, those sorts of civic issues that cities and residents used to complain about, and universities over the years have tried to house students on campus but have simply lost out on that, maybe getting students for the most part in first year, but moving off campus. So it's that whole churn of having a university in residential neighborhoods and the mix of longtime residents and younger 18 to 24-year-olds primarily in the community. And, of course, what has happened over the 10 years of this professional association is that we've gotten, I think, better and better at looking at our best practices, our common challenges, doing some research that communities can benefit from. So it's really grown. And then at the same time, over the last 10 years, the International Town and Gown Association, you know, what's happening in Ontario is happening across Canada, across North America, and around the world. There are, of course, thousands of universities that have been around for hundreds of years, and yet it's something that's been really sort of under-researched. And so it has been this last decade where we've seen, certainly in Ontario and Canada, that's been the dominant area, but across Canada and around the world now. So the Ontario group have really been pioneers, Kay Crawford, and in fact, in the early days, some people from Brock were very instrumental in starting the Town and Gown Association.
So there is an international and there's an Ontario. Are there associations, Town and Gown Associations, throughout the country or throughout North America?
Not really, no. It's been an interesting sort of here and there. Many, many communities have their own sort of local civic university Town and Gown Committee. Very often it arises when there is a problem where the university president is called to account for the behavior of the students at the university. It's always a situation that is full of tension. Certainly Queens has endured this over the years with their homecoming. Western has had some issues around St. Patrick's Day. These sort of student rituals, perhaps, that we might call them, where sometimes it gets out of hand. And of course, they're not always students, local residents and young people. Queens had 6,000 and 8,000 and 10,000 people coming from far and wide to attend their homecoming parties. And this is where we ended up having the riot police called in and significant amounts of security, ultimately canceling their homecoming. And they just reinstated it again this year, and they had 3,000 or 4,000 people back again. So every town has its issues. Of course, the bigger the community, you know, the Torontos and the Montreals and even the St. Catharines of the world, where you would have probably maybe 15% of the population in this sort of student university college age range. So the smaller the community, a place like Sackville, where I am here in New Brunswick, we have 30% of the population is a student, and 5,000 local residents and 2,800 students. So it's a different sort of college town environment. But no matter where we are, having a university in the community has all sorts of benefits, but primarily civic leaders have had to deal with problems, police, police confronting student service and student government professionals, that sort of thing. But Ontario, I think because of the sort of the dominant Ontario college system, where we still have a fairly large percentage of university and college budgets coming directly from the province, I think that's been a more consistent approach. Certainly the town and gown organizations in Ontario are really ahead of the game on that.
How would you handle a problem area between a community and a university? In other words, do you have any mandate to go out and perhaps act as, for want of a better expression, an ombudsman in a case like this? Or what are you able to facilitate between the two sides?
Well, I think that's a really good characterization of it. I think forward-looking communities have taken this challenge and this set of challenges to heart, and maybe a little slow coming to the table have been the universities, actually. And this is the age-old sort of university tradition, the ivory towers, the place on the hill. You know, in fact, I went to Western in London, literally a former golf course up on the hill, removed from the town. And we have throughout history the university with walls and gates and moats around it, the sort of Oxford and Cambridge model. And so universities are an entity almost unto themselves, and often forget that they're in a community and that they have a whole number of civic relationships there. So the town or city government, mayor and council, the police, the fire, they have to, and they are, really have a symbiotic relationship. And when things go badly, there has to be an individual and a group of individuals that have a mandate to basically address those issues. And, of course, what my role is in the book that's just come out is that I'm trying to get civic officials to have an ongoing relationship with the university and bring both parties to the table. So having a committee is important, but one not just to deal with problems when they come along, but now looking at the economic opportunities, the investment, the role of having all of these hundreds and thousands. You know, St. Catharines has got close to 20,000 really, really bright, active, engaged people in their community. And this has got to have all sorts of positives associated with it. So I think that idea of individuals and committees and groups that are looking at this at a regular basis are going to prevent those sort of episodic problems and really concentrate on making this relationship work, especially in a place like Southern Ontario at the moment, where there are so many economic challenges. A place like Brock and St. Catharines really does become a major economic engine for the community. And I think individuals from the president, the vice presidents, student government, and individual students become economic factors, economic actors in the community, as well as consumers and people who want to socialize and go to restaurants and coffee shops, pubs, etc. So there has to be a relationship there, and it starts at the top. I'm the first to say that when the mayor and the university president have that relationship, they can make things work very well. They can lead a whole number of other people, but I think student governments, police departments, recreation offices, landlords have a huge role in this. So it's more than just one person sitting in an office. I think it's a group that are really engaged in looking at making the relationship stronger.
Would it be safe to say that rowdy behavior off campus is really one of the hot button issues in a case like this?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And, you know, I've always been amazed that we haven't done a better job of planning this. I mean, it's like the seasons, isn't it? I mean, you know, everyone knows come September, several hundreds or thousands of young 18 to 24-year-olds will be arriving in the community, moving away from home, many of them for the first time. Experiencing that freedom, and also upper year students returning to help teach that liberation and freedom. And those students have now moved off campus and are living in higher densities, close to campus perhaps. So parties, socialization, these are absolutely some of the big hot button issues of a community. So residents often come to dread having the return to school, and that's a real shame. Simple things like having students go next door and meet their neighbors and introduce themselves, and likewise having residents go over and tell them what their expectations are, maybe bring them some muffins along the way, or say if you're having a party, you know, make sure you invite us to the party. Those sort of simple things are really the start part of a good relationship, like in any neighborhood, where, you know, rather than vilify all students or paint them with the same brush, that they're all noisy and they're all they're going to park on the lawn and urinate on my flowers and have rowdy parties. This us and them attitude really is a sort of rite of passage of those first weeks. And then, of course, then there's the end of year when over a 1 or 2 week period, those thousands of students leave the community and often leave a lot of their garbage and furniture and other things behind. Couches end up on the front lawn, sometimes on fire. So these are the literally hot button issues that communities, unfortunately, sometimes end up dwelling on rather than the benefit of having those students in the community.
I was chuckling to myself when you were giving that last description, because that is the picture that we all see in St. Catharines come April. A lot of abandoned couches of various descriptions on boulevards all over the city, and you can't get away from that. I don't know if you could come up with like a code of conduct, if you will, for university students and the neighbors, the rest of the community, so that they can get along with each other. But there must be some basic things that both sides can do, as you suggest, getting to know each other first off, so that you could nip a lot of these conflicts in the bud before they become overblown.
Oh, yes, exactly. I think I'm not sure if it's still going on in St. Catharines, but Brock Student Union used to do, I think they called it Community Connections, where they did work with students and say, you know, if you're moving off campus, these are the basic rules of behavior. Also helping them in an ombuds-like way with housing issues. You know, if you move into an apartment, there are housing regulations, and Ontario's got some very clear rules there in terms of leases. And so, you know, you have to have a functioning toilet, and your landlord has to repair things, and you have to have certain standards of appliances, and, you know, the big one, of course, smoke detectors. I'd be willing to predict, you know, if you walked into half of the off-campus housing units in St. Catharines, they probably don't have a functioning smoke detector. So, you know, there's some really serious ground rules that communities can work with universities and student governments to set these. I think what you're right, a code of conduct is a good way of phrasing that. And that's certainly where then your planning department, bylaw enforcement officers, police, campus security, they can all work together in making sure that, you know, not that you're looking at enforcement as the single only option, but certainly if everyone's playing by the same rules, that's really helpful. And many campuses, many universities are building this into their orientation activities. It's often, again, not those first-year students, because they're to a large degree living in residence, and we know that there are all sorts of rules there. It's when they move off campus, behavior and the behavior of landlords sometimes becomes a little questionable. Having the internet, of course, has been really helpful, so we've got Rate Your Landlord Landlords now, those options. If landlords are going to be unscrupulous, they might end up on a do not rent list, you know, those sorts of things. And I think town governments, city governments are really seeing this as an opportunity where students, their ability to care about the community, the volunteerism in university communities is phenomenal. I mean, it's just incredible what university students are willing and interested to do. This notion of community engagement activities now across North America has really been helpful to these communities. So I think a code of conduct and also a strategy to maybe have some of these students remain in the community. So it's always, been interesting to me that students are seen as being sort of short-term and fleeting and not really offering anything to the community. But my goodness, the relationship, that symbiotic relationship between the university, the life of the downtown, right where your radio station is, if you're in the downtown and there are students all around you, they're going to be close to and need to shop and to have coffee shops and bookstores, and they're certainly going to consume and volunteer in the community as well. I mean, that's the essence of sort of the community engagement side of planning. So I think there's all sorts of opportunity there that when you have that sort of relationship, that poor behavior certainly goes down.
And you have to have the cooperation of all parties, the student union, the students themselves, the community, and the municipal government. They basically all have to be on the same page and say, here are the problems, here's what we're going to do about it.
Yes, that's right. I've, again, been trying to point out the various communities I work with. In most places, we often think of the city as the sort of the big partner there. But when you think of it, just a quick look at Brock and the city's websites, Brock's got an annual budget of $300 million, whereas the city of St. Catharines' budget is just over $100 million. So the university is actually a phenomenal economic partner. No community would want sort of one of the biggest, if we can call a university an industry, but certainly biggest economic engine in the community. You certainly wouldn't want to be at odds with them. You'd want to work very carefully in terms of economic growth and development. And I know that certainly Brock and past presidents and student governments as well have worked with the city of St. Catharines. I'm not suggesting that they don't, but you always have to be aware of that. I mean, just think of the 1,500 faculty and staff at Brock. That's a huge employment opportunity. And, almost 90% of the students at Brock live in the community. So it's an absolute for the civic government, as far as I'm concerned.
It's funny that you mention that, the size of Brock and the population.
Yeah.
What people maybe don't always realize is the fact that someone mentioned to me in the fall, and even I hadn't realized it until they mentioned it, Brock is essentially one of the largest employers in the city.
It is indeed, yes. Even the entire Niagara region. I mean, it is the educational institution. Certainly the colleges are important as well. But in terms of, you look at the research now that's going on at Brock and any other community, as Richard Florida at University of Toronto suggests, this notion of a creative community is now really has replaced, sort of the manufacturing industries of cities of the past. It's this creative group, the research potential, the economic impact of having that $300 million, I'm sure at least half of it is coming from those very students, undergraduate and graduate students that are coming to learn and live in the community. So, anywhere else, I guess for a long time, we've always used the sort of what's good for General Motors is good for Detroit model. That's probably not a good example anymore, and just shows us how, look at Detroit now without General Motors and their bankruptcy. So what would St. Catharines and the Niagara region be without Brock University? That's not to suggest that the university doesn't have a responsibility to be the best of partners here. And when you're dealing with humans, young people, researchers, highly paid, highly educated faculty and staff, it's a really dynamic and fragile relationship, that's for sure. You really do need to give a lot of attention to that. And if you don't, like any relationship, then it gets tired and problems start to happen. And you need intervention and counseling. The analogies come quickly here.
And I do want to mention the fact that not every student at Brock University is presenting problems any more than at any other university. It's usually a small group that give the university population as a whole a bit of a bad name. And therein lies the problem. It's not everybody who's causing the problem.
Oh, no, absolutely not. But, the media, and I don't want to paint you again and others with a broad brush, but, the media certainly has a role in this. If it's something sensational, like a massive house party where there are police interventions and the fire department is called and the neighbors have called the newspaper and written to the editor, this is what takes in a significant amount of attention and is played in the media. The students that go to the local elementary and secondary schools and coach basketball and working with their local churches and cleaning up the streams and rivers and lakeshore, they don't always get noticed, and that's part of a community as well. But the sort of sensational hot button issues that we mentioned earlier sometimes dominate people's consciousness and people get stereotyped. And students, like any other population group, sometimes get stereotyped. Student housing, for example, is something that irks me, because use any other descriptor than student and you're into some human rights issues. So you don't classify and have land uses according to what people actually do there. And so students often get demonized because of the actions of a few, that's for sure.
The book is called Town and Gown, From Conflict to Cooperation, and it's available now from municipalworld.com. And our guest has been Michael Fox, who is a professor in the Department of Geography and Environment at Mount Allison University in Sackville, New Brunswick. Thank you very much for your time today, Professor.
Well, it's been my pleasure. Thank you.
And there we heard an interview we first aired back in December on the program with Michael Fox, professor in the Department of Geography and Environment at Mount Allison University in Sackville, New Brunswick. He's a member of the International Town and Gown Association and the Town and Gown Association of Ontario. He's also the author of a new book entitled Town and Gown, From Conflict to Cooperation, published by Municipal World Books. That's it for this edition of Inquisitive Minds on CFPU-FM 103.7 in St. Catharines. My name is Mike Saunders, and I hope you've enjoyed the show. You can contact me via email at any time at talk@cfpu.ca with show comments and suggestions. Until next week, always remember to have an inquisitive mind. Thank you.